The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts,
Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. Welcome to the BioRevolution Podcast. This is not an ordinary episode, but we're approaching 4 years in the field of the BioRevolution Podcast and our 50th episode. Congratulations, Izzy.
Congratulations to you. I think back in the day, so we started sitting on your kitchen table discussing for hours about BioRevolution topics. And then we said like, maybe we will make a podcast. And then I think both of us, we thought, right, it would run for maybe 5 episodes. I didn't have these high expectations. I just thought, yeah, let's try it and could be cool. Yeah. And now we're at 50 episodes. That's actually pretty nice.
It's just amazing. And my learning curve has been really steep. And I am so thankful for really exploring topics that for me as a journalist and podcaster are closed shop in real life.
For me, it's still kind of the same because a lot of the topics that we discussed also with our guests, I mean, I knew about them superficially, but then really diving into it, I think was a great experience and learning so much. Pretty nice.
And we should give a huge thank you out to our listeners, of course, because you've made this possible, because we saw that in our statistics that the growing number of people who were interested in what we had to offer, that of course made us thrive and go on, basically, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if no one would listen, we would probably stop doing it. It's like doing art for art's sake. It's nice, but it's also nice if someone wants to look at it or listen to it.
Right now, I'm pretty sure that we'll make it to episode 100. What do you think?
Absolutely. I think so. You just have to open the biotech news and like crazy stuff is happening every day. There are so many other things that I still want to talk about, from astrobiology to computing based on brain cells to all these kind of crazy things that are happening and could be happening. And we will have easily topics to fill 100 or many more episodes. What we want to dive in a little bit today is artificial intelligence. And I think this is especially an area where the movement is kind of overtaking the speed of development. It's really, really hard to follow, because when we started this podcast and when we had our first AI episode, it was pre-ChatGPT. And then we know language models, transformer architectures, they changed. I mean, they didn't only change biotech related topics, but they actually changed, I would say, society in a sense. And I think it's something that's noticeable across so many areas. Yeah, we're kind of like witnessing the revolution in real time and we're talking about it. And it's kind of cool.
Yeah, and that's so interesting to have under the microscope a topic that is developing as we speak and things are changing. We actually don't know what will be the AI truth in a month or in 2 weeks, probably, because new things keep popping up and that keeps it so interesting. And therefore, you put the title on today's episode that will be out of the ordinary and not the usual thing, because we have a lot of guests that we will recapture what they said. You titled The Good, the Bad, and the Overhyped 4 years of the Biomedical AI on the BioRevolution Podcast. And in fact, we had more than a dozen guests who were speaking to the topic, which is kind of amazing. It speaks for itself.
Absolutely. And we had these broader overall discussions, but we had also a number of examples of people just showing really cool applications of AI, which I think is also very nice in this field, where often, and I think this is something that we noticed in the beginning, there is a lot of hype and there is a lot of people who have a semblance of knowing what they're talking about. But if you dig a little bit deeper, you can tell that there's a lot of buzzwords around it, and there's very little substance. And I think especially in the AI and biotech field, in the beginning, it felt a lot like that. So you had like this really overhyped situation where it was like everything was going to revolutionize and drug development was changing really drastically, getting really faster and better and with a higher probability of success. And I mean, this still has not happened. That said, I think there is a lot of cool stuff happening, and we'll dive into that in a second. But I think what we discussed in episode 35, we had a quote from a biopharma leader who actually put into question, what are we actually going to do with it? And I think this really sums it up very nicely.
I think a general question is, if you're in the shoes of a biotech leader or a pharma leader or medtech company, there is so much hype around AI, and everyone is talking about it, and everyone has use cases, anecdotal evidence, and McKinsey forecasts of hundreds of billions of dollars per year that you somehow have to set free with AI. And then at the same time, you're looking at it and you might be wondering, what am I going to do with it?
And I think one of the challenges here is that AI is kind of a computer science engineering-based discipline, but in biotech and in biomedicine, we deal with biological systems. And they're extremely complex, and the data behind it is extremely complex, and we're trying to break it down to something that AI can compute. And this is not always possible. And we had a really nice quote from one of our guests in episode 46 from Ingmar Schuster. He's a founder of Provolut, AI-driven protein design startup. And he summed up this situation of biological complexity and what AI can do about it really nicely.
We have a biotech founder and CEO of Provolut today with us, Ingmar Schuster, who also brought us a quote about maybe the AI hype in protein design and biotech per se.
So yeah, currently, I think what most people perceive AI for biology and biotechnology as is, it's like a windshield wiper when it's raining heavily. So biology is super complex. AI helps a bit, but then the next problem comes around. And I think everybody understands what the potential is, but it is not as fast to realize the potential as compared to areas where there's vast amounts of data like text and images and video.
Yeah, the picture of a windshield wiper puts it into perspective in a sense. The overall question, and I think you found one snippet of episode 31, I think, where it sums up the topic of creativity versus productivity.
Yeah. So, I mean, here we just really ask the question, what is AI so far really doing for pharma? And I think this is about a year ago that we discussed that. And I think we're actually still in exactly the same situation than back then.
Are they really bringing molecules into the clinic, targeting targets that will be, in the long run, be more successful? This we simply don't know yet. And I have to say that the targets that these drugs are targeting, so what we're really biologically addressing, is currently not that different from drug targets that are discovered without AI, which makes complete sense. And I think we talked about that before. It's not so good to change too many factors in a system if you want to show that it works.
Time and again, we tried to explore good use cases of AI in biomedicine, which is quite a distinction to the daily use of ChatGPT, for instance, and things are very, very different. And we have examples for that too in our episodes, right?
Yeah, I mean, we had so many cool guests and we cannot feature them all because otherwise the episode will get too long. But we picked a couple of examples of really cool AI use cases. And the first one, again, is from Ingmar, who we just heard from, in designing proteins that don't exist in nature with AI. And we talked about that many times on this podcast with large language models, but also with other types of AI, that reading molecular languages and putting that into use to design new proteins, of course, has massive potential for biotech and pharma.
As for your question, don't we have enough proteins? proteins in nature have not evolved to do the things we want them to do. One very simple example of this is pharma production, a field that Provolut has worked in as a consulting company partnering with Big Pharma. So Big Pharma wants to produce their compounds, their therapeutic compounds, and nature typically catalyzes reactions. So proteins that catalyze reactions, enzymes, they catalyze reactions from one tiny molecule to another tiny molecule. And quoting a scientist from Sanofi, in pharma production, it's bulky substrate, bulky substrate, bulky substrate, and that never happens in nature. So you are dealing with big, big molecules that you're trying to assemble, basically, through biocatalysis. And it's just not something that nature ever wanted to do. It's not interested in that.
So those are the new proteins that don't exist in nature. We also refer to something I didn't have a clue at all of, which is called the dark genome. I think we can paraphrase it otherwise as well, which shows how limited our knowledge is, right?
Yeah, and I have to say, I mean, this is something even when I was studying biology, we still thought that there is really a very limited number of protein coding genes and the rest of the genome is junk. There are always in biology, we always have this strange notions like we're only using 10% of our brain, only 2% of our DNA is meaningful. Usually it's just a question of, okay, we have not understood yet what the rest that we consider non-functional is doing. And that's the same for the genome. And we had a fascinating conversation with Hossin. He's the CTO and co-founder of a Berlin-based startup called Lucid Genomics. They are using AI to decipher the dark genome, so actually put meaning to the 98% of our genome that does not encode proteins and still has a function. And this is, of course, a really fascinating use case for AI.
Maybe this is where the AI comes to the game. AI helps us from two parts. One is it finds patterns very well on big data. Of course, in biology, we want to know mechanisms, but AI helps us to shed light on patterns. And from the other side, we are able to denoise data with AI. So in this game, in dark DNA game, AI can help us from two parts. First, detecting the mutations in a higher accuracy. And when I talk to mutations, we talk about variations. We have small variations, we have larger variations, structural variants, we have tandem repeats. And that's one part that AI can help us. And from the other part is like, now I know the variations, how I can make sense of these variations in different tissues, individuals, populations. This is where AI can help us a lot with pattern finding.
Can't wait to see results here.
I have to say there are results. There are a number, and we had a follow-up episode with Sutakaran where we talked about the dark proteome. And there are a number of companies who are actually now exploring even protein coding sequences within this dark space of the genome, putting AI to it. And of course, there's massive potential for having new drug targets in there. Because if you imagine that you're actually missing out on almost 100% of the genome to target for potential applications, of course, not all of it will be targetable. But I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer that there is something to be found in there.
We also talked many times about rare diseases, of course. And in the conjunction of rare diseases and AI, things come to fruition pretty much. And we had guests from Bonn who are doing something that seems to point in a direction where we can find real solutions, right?
I would say so, yeah. I think this was also a really fascinating conversation with Adele and Banham. Adele is from Gestaltmatcher and Banham from Bone to Gene. They are trying to use image-based AI systems to actually point towards rare disease diagnosis, either on the face and other morphological features or on X-ray-based bone features. And of course, you can imagine there are a great number in the thousands of rare diseases, but there's only very few people who have it. So physicians will probably not recognize this phenotype. And this type of app that these companies develop would point a general physician towards a potential diagnosis and then help people finding out if they have a rare disease and what kind of rare disease this might be. And of course, many of these diseases, they develop in a childhood age, and you can imagine what it means for parents to have a child that has challenges that you simply cannot understand what's going on. And I think this is something where you really see the potential of AI to actually make patients' lives better or make people's lives better. It's a really great tool. And it's also one of these real use cases where the AI is already making a difference.
Gestaltmatcher is an AI tool that uses advanced computer vision methods or next generation phenotyping to recognize rare diseases in a simple portrait picture. So the idea is that in the clinics, the pediatrician or a different doctor would just be able to take a picture with their phone, have an app, the Gestaltmatcher app on their phone, and within a few seconds get a list, a ranked list of potential differential diagnoses.
Why do you think is AI actually so good at that, better than us?
The main thing is that with the increasing the amount of data that we have, and then the improvement of the algorithms, it's easy to, when we have the data, to train algorithms that can do this search and matching in a few seconds. So I'm not going to say that the AI is definitely better than a trained human. So maybe an experienced physician who has been working with these kind of patients for 40 years is as good as AI, I would say.
I think for Gestaltmatcher, a visionary plan is also to combine it with the smart glasses so that pediatricians have the smart glass and don't need to take out their phone, maybe even their personal phone. Maybe they are concerned with that. Also the children, they are young, they are moving a lot. They don't like sitting still for an image. So if they have a smart glass, maybe even we can make it work with a video. And I think that would be also easier for the clinicians.
You were referring to artificial proteins, lab proteins, and now we were also speaking about artificial cells, so created cells. And we had one of the most distinguished guests in that episode 41, which is Fabian Theis. He was speaking about virtual cells, which is even more sci-fi than the topic from the get-go, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, for virtual cells, I think at the moment, it's not so much about reproducing the cells. I mean, that would be more on a synthetic biology point. But what they are trying to do in Fabian's group, but that is also something that across the biotech field is gaining a lot of attention at the moment, is this idea of recreating the inner life of a cell using artificial intelligence. And I mean, that used to be done with rule-based models. And then you had like pages and pages of differential equations to say, like, if this happens, then this happens. Of course, it doesn't get anywhere close to the complexity of biology. It's like the windshield wiper, helps a little bit. AI can, of course, do that in a more high-dimensional space. So it, like, the option space of what AI can compute is just so much bigger than what any human can do. That, of course, this leaves a lot of potential for virtual cells. And yeah, let's hear what Fabian has to say about it, because I think this is one of the most fascinating applications of the field. Why we actually need virtual cells?
Yeah, thanks, Louise, first for having me. Thanks, Andreas, for the kind introduction. Quite excited to sort of talk about maybe the bigger questions we have in the field. And I think it's a good time to talk about this at the moment, because, you know, there's sort of this a bunch of revolutions coming together. And that's why this excitement, sort of this reformulation of, I guess, an age old question in the field, namely, can we, you know, sort of like we build cars where we have a sort of engineering plan, write up things, and then, you know, not just sort of randomly hack a few existing cars into bits and pieces and produce new ones. You know, can we build such a blueprint for cells, one that we ideally understand that when a particular modification happens, you know, these things and have this and that impact. Why is it relevant? I'm sure we're going to discuss a bit more later, but, you know, if you want to treat diseases, you want to understand where to sort of tune and do things. So this idea of a virtual cell, I'm quite excited. The definition, I guess, and, you know, there's sort of very different understandings, but I think sort of the highest level picture would be, and you cited Demis as an example, would be to build a system that can simulate cellular behavior under normal growth differentiation, as this beautiful Virchow citation was just formulating, but also, of course, under perturbation such as external influences, microenvironment, but then, of course, also particular disease. You mentioned Aviv Regev. She's a good friend, one of the real lighthouse figures in the field and fantastically integrative person. She, together with Sarah Teichman and many of us, the two of them sort of really pushing it, has led this international consortium called the Human Cell Atlas that you might have heard about, and in some parts, spiritual successor to the Human Genome Project, Eric Lander also pushing for that and so on. Really nice community worldwide, very integrative. And that was, in a sense, the first type of data gathering that sort of helped even to spin out this idea of a virtual cell model.
Where would you say are the biggest payoffs in the nearer future for these virtual cell models? So how will they become useful? I think there is a lot of, I mean, academic groups, philanthropic groups, biotechs betting on the concept. So where would you say would you bet your money for the payoff?
I mean, I'm first now speaking as a pure scientist. So of course, you know, I want to understand in the end biology, right? So I make all these fun methods that is my core expertise, but then, you know, we want to find, understand the particular biological problems. There was one aspect. I think the other one that I bet on, and there's a whole bunch of startups as well as bigger pharma going into that, is a problem that my lab sort of initially formulated something like 6-7 years ago. We called it SCGEN. So this is generative modeling of a perturbation effects, particularly with drugs. And I think this idea of like just screening a big library of drugs for some effect is just coming a bit to an end, you know, sort of these, some of the low-hanging fruit, and this is of course not really low-hanging, but you know, some of these sort of easier ones have been maybe found, and now the ones that are there, you maybe want to combine, you want to sort of go in a new direction. So having a system that gives you even just a little bit of advice where to bet on, and not to make a full screen, but let me just screen, let's say 10% of that, but then you sort of have higher outcomes, or maybe understand how you can do combinatorics, which is such a big experimental space that you can never screen. You know, this, I think, will have major impact, and this is already happening now.
So again and again, we were also challenging, and we may have to remind listeners that ChatGPT was in the field since 23, when we had some episodes out already of the BioRevolution podcast. So that tells us a story about how timely we are with this podcast. And therefore, of course, the challenge is the hallucination, as we found out pretty soon. And the question behind it, how do we access good data that are promising for AI application in the field of the biorevolution and pharma development and drug development?
Yeah, this hallucination problem, and we have a quote from Sam Altman, one of the guys behind, or the guy behind OpenAI.
The guy.
You can also ask Elon Musk about this. There's a really nice article about that in New York Magazine, I think, about this history of the two of them and the legal battle. And yeah, but he very early on pointed out that these, I mean, hallucinations are a feature, not a bug. And we, in a number of episodes, we talked about the general challenges of AI, kind of the lay of the land with Paul von Bühnau. He's a mathematician and founder of an AI consultancy, IDA Lab. And he is really good, I think, at putting these things into context. And he explained why we actually have these hallucinations and how we can deal with them. The model will confidently state things as if they were facts that are entirely made up.
It's not so easy. because the whole hallucination issue is something that that is like inherent in the technology, which is a technology that is learning patterns from the past and then is generating patterns. But there will always be something that is a real pattern that you see in data, but that doesn't make sense in reality. I was just wondering in which area probably would we maybe not have an hallucination issue at all? And maybe that's music, because it's art. And what is wrong in music?
I mean, that brings us also back to which doctor do you benchmark it to? Mm-hmm. What is wrong? Because, I mean, humans also make mistakes and we say wrong things. Is that a hallucination or is it just, I mean, our brain also autocompletes stuff and a lot of the things that we come up with. I mean, sometimes you also just use the wrong word, but also sometimes you just produce information that's simply not true because you memorized it wrong or because you have strange ideas about the world or whatever. And then, I mean, we don't call that hallucination.
At the crossroads of philosophy and AI, I like that a lot.
Exactly. And I mean, something that we also asked him, I mean, where does he see this field going? Because I mean, at the moment, deep learning and especially large language models is what people consider AI. So if you talk, I would say to a lay person on the street, for them, AI is a large language model. It's a little bit like a tempo situation. I mean, it's not, it used to be ChatGPT. Now it's a bit more like diversified that people would also consider Gemini or Claude or something. But I think for many people, what they consider AI is a large language model. And there is, of course, much more to AI. There are rule-based AI models. There are other deep learning applications that have different architectures. And the question is, should we actually bring back world knowledge? So should we teach these AI models more about the world? And this will be something that remains to be seen, but we had Paul's take on that, which I think was really interesting.
That's a general issue with all machine learning systems that essentially just learn from data. Because we always talk about these models as models, and they are mathematical models, but a philosopher would probably say they are not a model because there is no causal mechanics that we infer, etc. These things are often black boxes and there is very little in terms of like epistemology or whatever. So the big next frontier is, as you've said, combining symbolic AI, which means like bringing in real knowledge that we have around the world, and combining that with something that we learn from data and making these two things work together. But there we are at the very beginning. But that's super exciting.
One of the key bottlenecks for AI and biomedicine is the data, because the data is not made up in the way that is perfect for training AI models. And we talked about that in different episodes. What Mark Twain says is data is like garbage. You better know what you're doing, what you're going to do with it before you collect it. And I think that's really interesting because when we're talking about AI and data, there's this adage that's being used in almost every lecture, every talk about it, which is garbage in, garbage out, which of course says like if you don't have good data, whatever your AI engine will calculate will also be garbage. We will deal with data that is not as structured and not as usable as we would like, because, and I think this is a general big challenge, not only when it comes to patient data in terms of their medical history, but also when it comes to scientific data about genetics, about any kind of drug development. We have a lot of missing data points, and the data is not meant to be analyzed by an AI engine or to be put to use in the way that we now want to use it, because, I mean, it had a completely different purpose in mind when it was produced. So it's not good data, basically. It's not data that's in a format that's very usable. There's this bias in academia, which also makes sense from a strategic point of view, to never publish negative data or very, very rarely publish negative data, because the journals are not interesting in knowing I worked 5 years on something and I found nothing. But the algorithm would be very interested in this information because we basically have a strong bias towards positive outcomes, and we can infer non-information as potential negatives, but we cannot be sure. Maybe, I mean, there's the possibility no one ever explored this, or someone explored that for a long time, but it didn't work. Maybe it also did work, but I don't know, the PhD student decided to become a yoga teacher instead and left the project and no one picked it up again. But then data is not everything. And I selected this really funny quote from Demis Hassabis, the founder of DeepMind and recent Nobel laureate, who actually says that the data doesn't matter as much if you just have a good model. And since they usually have the best models, maybe he is proven to be right. There are people who say that Demis Hassabis has hidden the AGI, so the really smart one, in his basement, and he just waits to release it on humanity. So let's see where this is going.
Make your algorithms better, your models better. You do have enough data if you were innovative enough on your algorithm side. I found that a little bit funny, quite provocative, I have to say. I won't name names.
Yeah.
So this is really like going against this trend of data generation that we're going to get into in a second. So yeah. I think this captures the whole scale.
So we also had a subtitle in this podcast in the very beginning, the first like 15 episodes or so. It was not only the BioRevolution podcast, but also We're Doomed, We're Saved. So we quit this because it's for the search engines too complicated and stuff like that, and stuck to the BioRevolution podcast. But still, we're addressing the pros and cons, the doomsday scenarios, as well as the saving part when it comes to rare diseases, for instance, and what AI can do here. But the general question, of course, we address that as well. How might the AI-driven pharma medical world look like, BioRevolution world look like? And also, what could possibly go wrong for the dooms part?
Yeah. I mean, there have been so many doom scenarios, right, for AI, even before AI was really capable of doing a lot. And I think it's really smart to think about that. I think it's for this dual purpose technologies, like for nuclear energy, for biological technologies like gene editing, for artificial intelligence, that can be used for the good and for the bad, depending on the actor. Really important to think about the question, what could go wrong before it actually does go wrong. And in some of these situations, both for biological applications, but also for AI, there's the question, it's not even only about bad actors, but it's about what can actually happen if it goes out of hand and if it develops a life of its own, let's say, and starts to make decisions. There's actually a very recent scary example of ChatGPT hacking a website by itself. So these are the situations there are, and we talked about it in the past a lot. There are glimpses of AI doing scary things, but I think in general, this is still not what we should worry about the most. It's more about the question of what actually people, what kind of bad things people can do with AI. One thing that we discussed also with Adela and Banham is this question of facial recognition, because there is, of course, a lot of, let's say, scary potential in there. If this is in the wrong hands to diagnose features just based on your face, which you use for, I mean, biometric scans, you use for a lot of different things, right? So using this in a sense to open your phone, whatever, but then an AI reading out some kind of medical information and informing your insurer, informing your boss, informing maybe the country that you're trying to enter about these conditions, for example, that you might have some mental condition or something like that. That is, of course, pretty scary. So, I mean, at the moment, we're talking about rare disease diagnosis, but there are, for example, applications for facial recognition of conditions like schizophrenia or something like that. That could be really scary. And then there's the reverse, and we discussed that also, which is, of course, the question, what can you actually construct facial features based on genetic profiles? And what could you do with that in terms of finding criminals? So it's really the question of which kind of biological surveillance you could imagine.
Let's talk ethics
a
little bit.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it has a, maybe it has a smell even for those who are not in science.
Yeah, for Gestaltmatcher, we also thought about this, of course.
Of course, you need to.
Which is why we implemented this registration process, and it's not open to everyone. With the physicians, it's quite clear that it's for a medical purpose. Right. But of course, if you give it to in the hands of everyone, it's a different thing.
Are there any worries? I mean, privacy, but also this question of someone takes a picture of my face and diagnoses me with a disease without me wanting this kind of situation. Is that something that you have come across as a worry, or is it because it's really physician limited, no challenge? I think facial features are something that is very explainable to the public. I think mm-hmm. it's something that is accessible to all of us, whereas looking at an x-ray or radiograph picture or retina picture, no one would be able to make any sense of, right? Who is not, I mean, sure. if I see a picture, if the bone is not clearly broken, I would probably not know what I'm looking at. Yeah. But face is something that we see all the time, that we also use, for example, to open our phones based on image recognition. So all these kind of things, I think, play into potential misconceptions mm-hmm. around this technology.
Izzy, what do you think about posing a visionary question?
A visionary question is something good, but I want to discuss very briefly, which might be visionary, but also something slightly scary, this Chinese study from the Chinese Academy of Science, where they did the reverse. So they used a genetic sample to reassemble facial features. I have to say, like from the images they showed in the paper, I would not be sure that I recognize this person on the street, but it's similar maybe to this, how do you call that in English? This phantom pictures that, you know, like the police draws. If
like
you see
almost forensic work.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, it is, it could be forensic.
Of course. Work, but could be used for that. Mm-hmm.
So this is, I mean, has nothing to do really with Gestaltmatcher, but it goes in the other way, right? It's the question that if you can assume a genetic component based on the morphology of a person, you can, of course, also go the other way around. And AI seems to be, this was a study from this year, where, which I didn't introduce properly, but where the scientists apparently were able to use genetic profile to reconstruct faces, which, of course, leaves us with a massive amount of ethical questions, legal questions, and just shows that, I mean, AI and the link between genetics and morphology is really moving in a new direction. I would say that if this would be something where I would say data protection for me would be very important, and I would really like those tools not to be implemented, because that could be quite scary to just collect DNA somewhere and say, like, oh, this is the person who left the chewing gum at the corner.
Now combine this with the genomic newborn screening.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Yeah. And we have like a perfect Big Brother society.
We're
yeah.
in a horror movie right now. Yeah, indeed. Scary stuff, promising stuff at the same time. And therefore, we're both, I think, so fascinated of what is going on really as we speak. And we started with that it's so fascinating to have a topic that develops not in the history books, but in the present tense.
Yeah. And I think that the last thing about the AI-driven future, and I think this is really the big question, will we merge our minds with AI? Will we allow the AI into our brains? And I think this is, for me, the big question of our future, which I find equal parts fascinating and scary. It's really difficult to predict the future of AI in the sense that the contribution of these models is just changing so fast. And I mean, I don't think that we've reached the end. So at the moment, we have this deep learning-based, mainly convolutional networks, and at the moment, transformer-based networks that are very efficient at doing certain tasks, but they're also not so good at doing other tasks. So it might be that I'm pretty sure that a lot of the AI companies are working on newer models that I at least have never heard about, but that, I mean, might have the similar effect as ChatGPT in 3 years. So that is one thing. And I think already, I mean, for these large language models, I think one of the developers I listened to, like an audio book where they discussed the potential of ChatGPT in medicine, and they said that it randomized the future. And it's a little bit true. I think, I mean, there was a big hype around ChatGPT, and it's not all that it's said to be. But one also has to say, in daily life, it's the first time, I think, that everyone really feels the contribution of AI. I think it's one of the fastest adapted user technologies that's out there. And this is something that is felt. So before, AI used to be something that maybe you talk about, or you, as you say, listen to Elon Musk saying it will lead to humanity's downfall, and other people saying it will lead to job loss and radiologists will be obsolete, and we will only have self-driving cars, etc. But I think ChatGPT is the first example where really most people, or many people, are using it and exploring also the interaction with an AI. And I think this is part of the future, I mean, irrespective now of drug development, that the interaction between the human and the computer will get a lot stronger, especially if anything that's integrated into the smartphones and potentially mainly in the next generations, also in neuroprosthetics, will just link us much closer to AI.
Absolutely. And I mean, we've been discussing that as well in our longevity episodes, for instance, you know, the digital afterlife and stuff like that, and the chip that helps us think or replaces our thinking and stuff like that. So that kind of wraps it up, 50th episode. We're ready for the sparkling wine now, because we didn't expect, as we mentioned in the beginning, that this would last more than 5 episodes. Thank you again for listening to us. More information and also in text at
sciencetales.com.
We already know what we do next time, right?
We do. We talk about AI.
Of course.
AI scientists, to be precise, and lab-in-the-loop models, so that will be quite interesting, I think.
That wraps it up. Thank you, Izzy.
Thank you. And thank you for 50 episodes.
Likewise.